Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 25th of December, these are our main stories. The Pope celebrates midnight mass at the Vatican. Following widespread protests, India's government allocates $1 billion to a detailed national census. And the Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny accuses Moscow of kidnapping his project manager. Also in this podcast, flooding in northeast Ghana earlier this year has left thousands still needing help. And the overwhelming sense of fear from mothers in Syria's war zones.
Every morning when we prepare them to go to school, we are afraid they won't come back.
We start this podcast at the Vatican. The traditional Christmas Eve Mass has been held in St. Peter's Basilica, where Pope Francis addressed the world's 1.3 billion Roman Catholics. He urged them not to let the Church's failings lead them away from their faith.
Su coloro che abitavano in terra tenebrosa, una luce refulse. Questa profezia della prima lettura si è realizzata nel...
Our correspondent in Rome, Mark Lowen, has been telling us more.
Thousands of people packing the splendid St. Peter's Basilica, Nick, with its fantastic gilded columns and its sculptures by Bernini and its paintings by Michelangelo, and a solemn Christmas Eve midnight mass held a couple of hours before midnight, as is traditional now. And there were readings, there were prayers in Arabic, Chinese, Swahili, as well as Portuguese and French, very much showing the desire by Pope Francis to extend the reach of the Church to the periphery. Some of the children who were chosen to be there came from Venezuela, from Iraq, from Uganda, again showing his focus very much on victims of war-torn countries and migrants. And it was a kind of solemn atmosphere, a very spiritual homily and a liturgy, as is traditional for the Christmas Eve midnight mass. And the Urbi et Orbi message, which he will deliver Christmas Day, that has a slightly more political feel, but tonight very much the focus was on the spiritual and on the religious.
And what were the main themes?
He spoke a lot about love, about divine love, about the grace of God and the need to give thanks for God's love. There were a couple of perhaps slightly more pointed messages. He talked about how we change, the Church changes, history changes, once we stop trying to change others but try to change ourselves. Now that comes from a Pope who is known to be more reformist than conservative, so perhaps a slightly more pointed message in that. And he also talked about you may have mistaken ideas, you may have made a complete mess of things, but the Lord continues to love you. Perhaps hidden in that is a message about those who have taken the wrong path in terms of clerical sexual abuse, perhaps the biggest crisis facing the Catholic Church today. So there was perhaps an undercurrent in there, but very much a focus on the grace of God and readings from that and the need to give thanks to what he says is a divine love which is unquestionable.
Mark Lowen. In India, the government has approved the allocation of more than $1 billion to conduct a census and population survey next year. The announcement came from the Minister of Information, Prakash Javadekar.
We are launching a massive program of national census, which happens every 10 years. Every house will be mapped, listed during April and September 2020. And in February 2021, head count will be done, and this is already accepted by all the states.
24 people have died in protests in recent weeks across the country over a new citizenship law. The idea is to offer amnesty to non-Muslim immigrants fleeing religious persecution from Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan. Critics say the legislation is anti-Muslim. They're also concerned next year's census and population survey will be a list from which doubtful citizens will have to prove they're Indian. Government denies all these allegations. Until a few days ago, our South Asia editor Ambarasan Ettirajan had been covering the protests from the capital, Delhi. He's now back in the UK and told me about the mood there.
On the one side, people are worried, anxiety and fear. When I spoke to a lot of these protesters, what they were saying is, come what may, we will come to the streets and protest because this is our chance to express our opinion. And also, many of them voted for the Hindu National BJP in the last election, mainly the students. And now they think, you know, they suddenly feel that the idea of India is coming under threat. You know, there was a lot of hope a few years ago. India is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It's going to be a $5 trillion economy. Jobs are everywhere. Now, all those things have dried up. People are really worried about, you know, where the next clash is going to start, what the government is going to bring the next bill. So this kind of anxiety and fear permeates through campuses. You know, India witnessed a very huge student protest in the mid-70s when a state of emergency was declared by the then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi. But this is another issue which has kind of unified the student community across India. People are protesting in the south, who don't speak Hindi. And then in the northeast, in Assam, they are protesting. And in western India, they're protesting in Mumbai. So it is kind of unified the nation. And there is a sense of, no, this is the time to stop. Where do we go from here? Whether India wants to be a secular democracy or a Hindu nation as prescribed by some of the right-wing groups in India. But the government insists that, you know, this particular law was brought in because these people fled religious persecution and they have to be given accommodation here.
Ambarasan Ettirajan. The latest news from Syria's Idlib province is that the death toll in the latest offensive by Syrian government forces against rebels continues to rise, while the United Nations says tens of thousands of people have been displaced. On a wider note, the Syrian conflict has changed the lives of millions of citizens, and women are at the very centre of trying to hold families together. In another of our series of reports from women who've endured long periods of conflict, we hear from Nasreen Abdulrahman, a teacher in Qamishli, the largest Kurdish city in northeastern Syria, where Turkey launched a military offensive in October.
When Turkey, the war started here in our region, there were bombardments. So they stayed at home for 3 weeks. They didn't go to school. November 11th, they were going out of school to get home, and they saw the explosions. Their pencils, erasers, books were all on the ground. 4 months ago, the explosion took place at a church next to my daughter's school. Every morning when we prepare them to go to school, we are afraid they won't come back. I've been teaching for about 15 years. We have been in this condition about 9 years. It was a great, you know, struggle and agony. Things have changed and teaching became more difficult. It's like a war or a struggle, battle, whatever you want to call it. You know, there are not enough desks to sit on at schools. No new books. Books are all torn apart. When winter will come, and it will be too cold, the stoves aren't sufficient. 1 year we even burned our books to get some heat. Can you imagine this? Well, their psychology, to be honest, is very bad. They are hardly managing to study since they see the conditions. Some young girls, I hear them myself, they want to get married to young men in living or migrated to Europe just to get rid of the situation here. They are very young, you know, they are 14, 15, they are underage. Studying has become their last wish. They are psychologically collapsed. My young daughter has been sleeping with me since 2 years because she is afraid. Our role is just to stand still and be courageous to support our kids and husbands. Could you believe it that my boy that they told me, why did you bring me here? No one asked you to bring me out here to this life. I was astonished, and he is right. He is right. No parks, no security, no theaters, no playgrounds, nothing. There is nothing here. So they are right. But I have to keep encouraging them, and I mustn't collapse. You know, we have to move on, no matter how hard it is.
Customs officials in northern Vietnam have made a rather surprising discovery after they opened wooden boxes hidden inside shipping containers. They found more than 2 tons of pangolin scales and ivory. Pangolins are the most trafficked mammals in the world. It's thought these ones had been smuggled from Nigeria. Richard Hamilton reports.
Pangolins, or scaly anteaters, are strange, prehistoric-looking creatures. They're solitary, nocturnal, shy, and look quite cute. They've even been described as walking pine cones. But their scales are so strong they can resist a lion's bite, and their claws can dig through concrete. They also have very long tongues to lick up ants and termites. There are 8 species, 4 in Africa and 4 in Asia, which are protected by international law, and they're classified in a range from vulnerable to critically endangered. But they are still highly sought after in China, Vietnam and other parts of East Asia as a delicacy and traditional medicine. Dr. Dan Challander is an expert on pangolins from the Department of Zoology at Oxford University.
They're ground up and you see them in medicines which are believed and used to cure a whole range of ailments, different uses historically and today to cure asthma, psoriasis, rheumatism and even cancer, it's been purported. The meat is demanded in China and in Vietnam and it's believed to hold a tonic quality, so it's believed to nourish the kidneys. The believed medicinal uses seem unfounded to date.
Since the year 2000, it's estimated that 1 million pangolins have been trafficked. That's more than all the elephants, rhinos and tigers combined.
Richard Hamilton there. It's 30 years since the Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu was shot dead in a revolution in which some 1,300 people lost their lives. Only then were the ravages of the country revealed to the outside world. Among those on the first aid flight into Bucharest, having given up her job to go and report on the situation there, was our former correspondent Catherine Adams. This Christmas, she dug out her dusty recording of her first dispatch and retraced her steps to see what has changed.
I'm standing at Gatwick Airport check-in along with hundreds of people. The scene is one of chaos. We're all here after reading a newspaper article 3 days ago saying that a charity was offering free trips to Romania in exchange for a suitcase full of food.
On that flight were soap stars, celebrities, the great Larry Adler jamming with a Greek balalaika player, jostling with Prince Paul of Romania, and Romanian exiles getting ready to distribute the aid on the ground.
It is very desperate. I mean, I don't think people outside Romania realise how desperate. Romania is down to 10 days' supplies of food, and that is the truth.
So I'm at the baggage claim area and the airport is unrecognisable. 30 years ago there were soldiers, incredibly dark, barely a light bulb, freezing cold, chaotic and really quite frightening, and then suddenly the dilapidated carousel clattered into life. I thought it was gunfire for a moment. But today it's just gleaming, full of shops.
Mihai!
Catherine, hi, how are you, Catherine? Good to see you.
Oh my God,
good to see you again.
It's been so long, I can't believe
30
it.
30 years, no, 27.
You're not as grey
probably
as I am.
Yeah, well.
Let's go and find a Kusamoki or two and have a coffee, yeah?
Okay, let's do it, yeah.
My old translator, Mihai Radu, and I hadn't met since I left 28 years ago. I remember when we talked to people on the streets just days after the revolution, it was clear that celebrations were turning to disillusionment and anger.
Today is declared a national mourning day for the people who fell down during the revolution. It sounds like it turned a little bit into a sort of demonstration.
Okay, let's go in here. This looks nice. How do you think Romania's done over the last 30 years?
Well, we have the IT industry. Romania exports lots of software. We have the market economy, right of speech. We enjoy any other rights like a Western country. Back in communist times, we had money but nothing to buy. But now you feel very small when you don't have money and there's things in the windows and you look and you cannot have it.
So night's fallen and the city is swathed with beautiful fairy lights. I'm standing opposite the building where Ceausescu flew by helicopter all those years ago. Instead of crowds now, there is a monument, a kind of white obelisk to the people who died during those demonstrations.
I'm Alison Mutler. I was here for the revolution. As a journalist, I've been here for the last 30 years, more or less. So Romania had this very bloody revolution, and then Romania sort of embarked on the road to democracy and a free market economy. But after Romania joined the European Union in 2007 and NATO a bit before, things began to stall a bit. So that is when Romanians themselves, ordinary Romanians, began trying to change society by demonstrating, by creating non-governmental organisations, by putting pressure on the government. It's Romania's slow revolution.
So people power is back, and Bucharest citizens can now enjoy Christmas, banned by Ceausescu, at this huge Christmas market set up right in front of his North Korean-style House of the People. The new minority liberal government will have an uphill struggle to tackle problems like corruption and the labour shortage, but Romania feels optimistic again.
Catherine Adams there. A local authority in the French Alps has banned the use of open fireplaces in an effort to reduce pollution. The ban will apply from 2022 in the Arve Valley in Savoie, which has become one of France's most heavily polluted areas. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard has more details.
A crackling hearth, the smell of wood smoke, a warming glass perhaps of vin rouge. The perfect end, you'd have thought, to a day out in the pure mountain air around Mont Blanc. But, as it turns out, that's the problem. Too many residents and tourists are doing just that, and the mountain air is suffering. A haze of wood smoke, with its fine carbon particles, is causing more pollution than the traffic. The prefecture of the Haute-Savoie region recently decreed a ban on open fires in the Arve Valley. It pointed out that subsidies are available for installing cleaner wood-burning stoves. Some chalet owners are peeved, fearing it will dampen the region's appeal. But raise a glass if you're going soon. You've got till the end of 2021 before the traditional roaring log fire comes in for the chop.
Danny Eberhard there. Now, a quick preview of our special podcast on Christmas Day. It's called The Happy Pod, and it's presented by my colleague, Jackie Leonard.
We've made a list. We've checked it twice. The year's best stories, inspiring and nice. The Happy Pod is coming to town. The sports stars and the doctors, the kind kids and the smart will celebrate their stories, their courage and their heart. So you won't want to pout, you'll smile and you'll cry. A bit, all good though. And if you listen out, perhaps by and by, the Happy Pod is coming. Well, if not to town, then at least to the Global News Pod feed. And if you sent in your happy story, you might be in it too.
Now, as we record this podcast, pilgrims from around the world gathered in Bethlehem to celebrate the traditional Christmas midnight mass at the Church of the Nativity. These people were among the crowds who converged on the town to take part in the festivities.
To be in Bethlehem during Christmas time is special. It's a very historic city, and it means a lot to many different religions and Christians and Catholics, and it's a time for the holidays and it's a time to celebrate.
The city is different because it seems like people from all over the world are coming here. So I've already met people from Europe, from Africa, all over, just to come to celebrate this night. And it kind of feels like a little bit like New Year's because everyone's joining us in the square, and it's just been amazing.
From Bethlehem, our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher told us more.
I'm looking over Manger Square from a vantage point, and I'm seeing the, of course, sparkling lights, which make it so magical here at this time of the year, the centerpiece being the Christmas tree, but also a canopy of lights over the square, and people still milling around. It's been very busy here today, but attention is now beginning to focus to the main event, which is Christmas Mass, of course. This is celebrating the humble birth of Jesus Christ, as the story is told. But the Mass itself takes place in quite a grand church, which has been built on the place where it's believed he was born. That involves dignitaries coming, as well as Palestinian officials. The Palestinian president has arrived already. I can see a couple of ambulance lights flashing. They're parked outside the church in case there's any emergency, I suppose. But the service, I'm told, is also going to be full of pilgrims who've come for this event. You apply early to get in a ticket so that you can come and have a very special Christmas here. And for that reason, I think most of the people will be foreigners. The local Christians, I'm told, have their Christmas Mass the next day. And so they will be pleased, I'm sure, to get as many visitors as possible. And this year has been a very busy tourist season, the busiest in the past two decades. And that's very important for Bethlehem because it relies on tourist income. It's the main industry here. But in this holy land, the Christmas cheer always comes wrapped in the political realities. And that was pretty much evident earlier in the day when there was a procession from Jerusalem by the Christian leaders. They came through an army checkpoint in the separation barrier built by the Israelis, a big cement wall here. Again, pointing out that Bethlehem's is fragile, its future is fragile, and that although it may be having a good season, nobody's quite sure what 2020 will bring.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Let's take you to Ghana next, and specifically the northeast of Ghana, where thousands of displaced people are still in dire need of help after weeks of heavy rainfall wreaked havoc in October. The country's National Disaster Management Organisation says it's only able to support a fraction of those who've suffered. The BBC's Thomas Nardi has visited the affected area.
Abongo Amolga, a local blacksmith, and his wife Alamisi live in Yorogua community in northeastern Ghana. They lost four relatives during the flood disaster in October. Their single room caved in on three children and an elderly woman following weeks of torrential rains. Alamisi Abongo explains.
I was out of the village when someone called to inform me that one of our buildings had collapsed. But they didn't tell me that I had lost my three children and my mother-in-law. It was when I arrived back home that I was informed. My life has never been the same again. Losing three children in one night is very painful.
There's still visible signs of destruction everywhere here. And then the building that collapsed is just a small room built with mud because of the nature of the soil here. It gave up when torrential rains continued for weeks. Though the flood waters have long receded and the dry spell has kicked in, the effects of the floods on families is still being felt. Relief efforts have been few and far between, and many victims are still struggling to rebuild their homes. Here at Serugu village, more than 100 residents were affected. Adukwa Yabe's family is one of them.
Now we don't have a place to lay our heads. And because it's very cold at this time of the year, I allow my wife and the younger children to sleep in the single room left, while I sleep outside with the rest of the children.
The National Disaster Management Organization, NADMO, and the Red Cross have been coordinating relief efforts here, but say their services are stretched. Francis Asare Akulbela is a NADMO official.
It affected more than 1,000 households in Bolga municipality. And because of the difficulty in the relief, we were unable to support as much as we can, but we were able to support about 135 victims. The relief items include mosquito nets, blankets, masks, and some small foodstuffs, which wasn't enough for the people. Most of the victims were expecting that if we could support them with reconstructional materials in terms of cement or roofing materials, that could be of benefit to them.
Hundreds of people are in desperate need of help, but with no additional government help in sight, many, including Alamisi, are quickly losing hope.
Thomas Nardi reporting from Ghana. The Russian dissident Alexei Navalny has accused Moscow's interior ministry of kidnapping a 27-year-old senior member of his anti-corruption foundation and illegally conscripting him into military service. Olga Evshina of our Russian service has been telling me more.
Ruslan Shavidinov is a member of most famous Russian opposition team, and some strange things started happening to him last evening. Officials came and, you know, his door was smashed and then he just disappeared from his flat. His friends went to the police. They said he's an investigative committee. Investigative committee denied it. So in the end, this morning, you know, he called from somewhere and said, you know what, I'm in Novaya Zemlya, which is a tiny archipelago in the middle of nowhere. That's far, far, far north. That's quite close to the North Pole, where one of the Russian military bases is situated. And of course, that's a close territory.
What are the Russian authorities saying?
Well, they're saying that Ruslan was warned in the beginning of autumn that he should join the military service because there is still conscription in Russia. He appealed to the court, and yesterday night the appeal was declined. And it seems that, you know, straight after that, police came to his flat and he was put onto one plane, then to another plane, and then he ended up in that military base.
Is this how Russians deal with conscription, getting people, allegedly abducting them?
Well, it doesn't happen that often, to be honest. But the research version, and actually I would say that this, well, not tradition, but this way of dealing with some people goes back to the Soviet Union, or when that way of dealing with people was quite often used in the sports. If there was some really talented guy, you know, when he reached the age of 18, he was destined to become a member of CSKA, Russian military sports team. And that's how they managed to become many, many times champions of Soviet Union in hockey, football, you name it, you know, just because all the best players had to join the army and serve there. Now it's sometimes used in a slightly different way. No one knows how lucky you will be with your military service.
So this service, how long is he likely to be doing it for?
Well, officially you have to serve for 1 year, and after that you can join as a contract member.
Olga Evshina. Four deer rescued by fire crews in the north of England have been named after the reindeer that are believed to pull Santa's sleigh. It's thought that Dancer, Prancer, Dasher and Blitzen became stranded after being washed downstream. Here's Claire Runacres.
The deer were spotted trapped close to the water on a grassy section of bank on the River Irwell in Salford. It's thought they'd been there for several days. Daring Dasher entered the water and swam to freedom. Prancer lived up to his name and managed to liberate himself by vaulting a high fence. But the others needed rescuing in an operation which took the RSPCA and Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue 4 hours. Dancer and Blitzen were eventually coaxed into the water but couldn't manage the swim to safety and had to be hauled on board the firefighters' boat before being taken upstream and released.
That report from Claire Runacres. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Qureshi. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One is reimagining banking by offering accounts with no fees or minimums that can be opened from anywhere in 5 minutes. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Capital One NA.